accession number 20729, reel 3.
This is Harry Flint, reel 2.
Right.
Now, more on ejector seats. Of course, that dilemma of the V-bomber layout was demonstrated at Heathrow, wasn't it?
Of course. I mean, nobody was very happy about it. I mean, I used to say to the crew, look, there'll be no chance of me leaving you guys behind. As long as I've got control of the bloody thing, I shall stay, you know. But on the assumption that I ain't got much control, I'm afraid I'd have to go, you know. But I would never have... you know, as long as I could fly it and he'd be in some sort of control, I wouldn't leave the bastards, you know. I think they... But it wasn't a happy situation, no. And I know, I think they were talking about it. I think it become obviously a bit expensive, I think, the trying to put seats in the back, you know. But I think there was some talk about it for some time then. Thought about modifying them, but they never...
On the American B-52, of course, all the blokes downstairs...
Mm.
Had downward firing seats.
Yes.
So they just didn't take it into the ground. So it wasn't.
And talking about that, you remember me talking about the Canberra before the T4? That was not very happy, you see, for people doing rating tests and people sitting in the rumble seat. I mean, when I was in Signals Command, I was taking people around, you know, ground people around doing. Checking on radar, they were having to sit on this damn...
Not even strapped in properly.
Oh, well, they just a little lap strap, and supposedly they'd have to try to jettison the door and jump out with this. You may remember when this chap from Bassingbourne bailed out with a runaway tailplane. You've heard about that with Canberras, haven't you?
No.
The tailplane of a Canberra. Oh, God, that was a hell of a saga, that was.
Yeah.
Well, the tailplane, you know, a movable tailplane, an electrical drive, all-flying tail.
Yeah.
It was single-pole wiring, as they call it, you know, and it was a very powerful trimmer. And so that when you were flying along, you didn't sort of operate it as a switch. You could constantly blip it. You'd be blipping it, you see. And I think there was a fair amount of arcing and one thing or another. One or two, quite a number of aircraft had just gone in, you know. They never quite knew why, you know. There was people accused of being drunk or the night before and not sweating on their oxygen and something like that, you know. And it wasn't until a chap at passing board, who was an instructor with a student, he was sitting in the left-hand seat, the student, and T4, and the other guy on this rumble seat.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the tailplane had started, it went on and on, this did. He must have ran fully nose up, he just touched it, it went fully nose up, so it went into this position, and, you know, couldn't get it down, went into a steep turn, so... No, I'm telling lies now. The student was on the rumble seat. The student was sitting there. So the instructor said, out the door. You know, with his power. So he did it, and he told the navigator to bail out. And what what went on? The navigator went, but the seat never deployed properly, and he was killed, the nav. And the squadron leader, I think he was a squadron leader in the seat, told this one to bail out. Well, as he tried to get out, he caught the parachute harness on the... There was a hydraulic handle for pumping down the wheels if you had trouble with getting the undercarriage down, and, you know, mechanical failure, pump failure, you'd pump the wheels down. And he got a strap caught on that, so he was sort of dangling out the door and was half, you know. And this guy pulled him back in, literally got pulled out and got him back up, pulled him back on the seat. And the story goes, this guy sort of smiled because he thought he hadn't got to go. And all he did was say, go on, you get your thing off this handle and jump, which he did. And he survived. He pulled the handle and that was it. The then pilot pulled the ejection seat and he went off. Got himself tangled in the damn... seat and one thing or other, And, amazing, as he was falling through four, he got his all tangled up. He got a penknife out of his pocket and cut himself free of the seat and came down and lived to tell the story. And I think from then on, we all carried knives then on our strapped to our legs, you know, so that you could be thought it'd be quite useful. This runaway tailplane, oh goodness me, it went on for a long time, and they were trying to fix it. They eventually did fix, put double pole wiring and things like this, but these incidents, everybody was aware of it now, you know, and they reduced the, eventually, they reduced the amount of this tailplane could move, you know, so it wasn't so violent, you know. And you used to have to test it when it came out of the hangar to see that it wouldn't, with full nose down, with that 400 knots, you could still control it, you know. But it went on. They grounded all Canberras. Everything stopped for quite a long time. And they said you could only fly the T4 because there was a much slower actuator. But even then, they started to run away. They don't really...
Because it's a standard form of trimming. I mean, I've flown in the 707.
Yeah, but I'm the Valiant. What you had to do was two switches. You try to operate one switch, nothing happened. You used to have to push the second switch, double pole, and then it would operate then. See, but this single switch, I don't think they knew what was happening, whether it was water or...
Well, because at altitude, you'll get arcing,
Yes, arcing, and you was also getting water maybe in the system, which would whatever, you see.
But a double pole, I mean, if one pole arced, yeah, then you were safe.
But this is a true story. It's worth recording.
Yeah.
I was on a little station bombing competition. I can't remember. I could find this guy's name if I looked, but perhaps I had an order. A little bombing competition for a cup, a little station cup, you know, for the usual rubbish. And one of the rules were that if you started the engines, you were committed, and you know, if you didn't go, you lost the points or something like this. So there was two of us, and I, the mother squadron, and I was one joker going for the cop, and this other fella, see. So we had all this problem with the tailplanes about them running away, and they more or less said, you know, if you had anything trouble with a tailplane, don't touch it. Keep everybody away, get the experts to come and take you to bits, you see. So this young chap said to me, we were walking back to the bus, and he said to me, guess what happened to me tonight? I said, I don't know. He said, I saw the tailplane run away. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, when I was doing the checks in the dispersal, he said, I put the tailplane to zero as the normal for taker. He said, and I watched it. It goes to fully nose down. Perhaps I was a bit older than him, you see. And I said, what did you do then? You see? He said, well, I got the chap outside the amateur check that he was fully down. I said, yeah. And he said, I didn't know what to do then. I thought, all right, I don't know, get out of that damn thing faster than that. But he said, talk to them if we didn't, you know. So he said, I operated it up and down a bit more, and it was all right. I said, what about the nav? What did he think, you know? So he seemed to be quite happy. So I thought,
he had his engines running at those times.
So yeah, he's committed, he's going to lose the points or something. So I said, well, what about, I said, have you, what have you done now? So have you put it in the book, you know, this bloody 700 of the aircraft, you know, that I'll not get it tomorrow. And funnily enough, you see, we'd had one run away the previous month. There was a chap called Front Flight Sergeant Johnson, and he had had the similar thing. He'd been sitting at the marshalling point, and he'd set the thing to zero, and when he looked at it again on the runway, the bloody thing was fully nose down. And he told, he did the right thing, told everybody. And they did all the tests and said, you must have landed on the switch or something when you changed channels. He said, no, I really didn't. He said, well, it, you know, they decided it. They didn't, couldn't solve it. The CO took it up and did an air test, and it was all right, and that was it, you see. So I said to this guy walking up to the mess, we were going to have a few jars now, you see. I said, you better tell somebody about this. I said, you know. I said, you better tell the boss. It was, what's his name? Squadronier Atkinson. And when you get in the mouth bar, so I could see him go up to Atkinson, see? And I could see he was listening to this story, you know, about how he'd operated his thing instead of leaving it and leaving the. He'd flown the trip. And I said to him, what are you a bit worried? He said, always keeping my eye on it. But I mean, it was ridiculous, you know. So he said, I could hear Watkinson said, come with me. And he took him to the station commander. He said, tell him what you've just told me, you bloody idiot, more or less. And he did, you know. But why the hell he'd think of going? I mean, I was, you know, it was absolutely stupid. But he did it. Young man, say, for the points or whatever, operating it.
So Vickers eventually sorted that out.
Wasn't Vickers, it was English Electric, the Canberra, wasn't it?
Oh, it's the Canberra.
Canberra I'm talking about. Oh, yeah. They were all double part one, and I don't think they've had any trouble since, you know. Yeah. And they've certainly never had any trouble with the, I think it's the basis of most airliners now, you know, but.
Well, they have a little button on the yoke, don't they?
Yeah, well, you've got to, you operate two, you see, you trim it. You had to operate two, I suppose you do now, you've got to push them both.
Yeah. I've done it myself, I sat up front and watched them do it. But.
Yeah.
Now tell me, 138 Squadron, you joined it, what
yes.
was your job? You were still virtually doing what the Canberras did, didn't
you? Co-pilot then.
Yeah.
I said, but I joined a very experienced squadron and crew, you know. The NAVs were QBIs and, you know, I'd say they were hand-picked, these guys. Well, qualified bombing instructors, and the other one was a staff NAVs, you know. They were all being picked, you know, so. And I was relatively experienced, so it was a good time. It was easy, really. It was easy. Everybody did their job, and it was a good time. But then we were. I was training up. You wanted to talk about Suez, did you?
Yeah.
Well, we did give a revolver. That was a sudden panic, you see, that we were. Couldn't believe it, really, you know. Some of the aircraft weren't capable of going down there because they've been modified to carry the one weapon with the one, and they'd taken all these bomb stations out for the 1,000-pounders because they didn't think they were going to need them, I suppose. So to put them all back for this Suez campaign, you'd need about 3 months to get it all organised, you know. So I mean, if they'd have waited another 6 months, I don't think it would have been anything. The camp balance wouldn't have been probably capable of going.
Your aircraft was fitted for Blue Danube, was it?
Yeah, well, some of them have been being modified for the big weapon bomb. Then,
yeah.
You see.
Was yours among them?
No, well, I don't know. We went anyway with the 1,000-pound. Some of them were all right, and off we went. We panicked. Well, we rushed out there, didn't know what was going on. Parked at Luca, and everybody said, "What the hell?" You know what I mean? And I think some of the Canberras have been carrying bombs out there. You know, for the war, you see. And they said, what's going on? Oh, shush, you know, it's all hush hush, you know. And then we were talking to this Nissen hut, and the guy rolled up the Hessian and said, there we are, we're going to bomb Egypt tonight. we must be joking, you know what I mean, out of the blue. So there it was, we were going to. We had all this briefing went on. But in fact, of course, they no chance would they have got those bombs on board with the armour as they'd got. And it took quite a performance to bomb up a Valiant. Did you know, have you heard about the... Well, you had to get a... It looked like a dinosaur, this thing, through a big sort of crane affair. You used to have to come across the top of the fuselage and drop things through to hoist the bombs up. It was quite a performance.
So did you bomb it up from the top?
So, yeah, these things were were hauled through. The Vulcan wasn't. I think it had its own motors to pull them in, but these things had to be, you have to position this damn big thing through the top, through the bomb station, and pull them up five, and then pull up three, and of course we never did it normally. We'd all practice, we used to take 100-pound practice bombs, you know, and not 1,000-pounders.
So what was the capacity? How many 1,000-pounders did it
carry? If I remember, it's five. We didn't carry them on pods. It was five, 16 1,000-pounders, two fives and two threes.
Now, I'm not quite sure, when you winch the bombs up, I mean, did the cables from the winch come down to the top of the aircraft?
Yeah, well, that was a kind of a big, a probe thing used to go through the holes in the top of the fuselage, right, get it, and then they'd lower this thing down. And it was all done from outside. These things were then winched up from this sort of dinosaur thing, you know. Quite a complicated business, and needed to be well trained, you know, and these lads hadn't done it very often, and trying to pull these damn bombs up with five at a time, then three, and then five and three, you know. And I think a lot of them didn't, you know, there was a complicated thing to reset, how the bombs had got to drop in the right order so they didn't hit each other. And I think one or two of these were messed up and they came back with hang-ups. Some of them didn't go, you know, there was all a waste of time going, you know.
Did you actually fly us off?
Well, that's right. When we got to the point that night, it was cancelled and was delayed for 24 hours, you see. And then we went through this very briefing about if we were shot down. That was the best part of it all. They gave us, if we were shot down, there'd be submarines in the Med to pick us up. And we had maps and blood sheets that said, you know, bags of sovereigns. You sign for a bag of sovereigns. So if you were shot down, you'd give these sovereigns to the Arabs, you know, to look after you. And it said a little thing in Arabic. It'd say, look after this man and the British government will give you £50 or something, you know. And one of the guys said, I'm writing on the bottom of mine, Mrs. Allebeck will give you another 100. But, you know, they gave us revolvers with bullets and the little packet of bullets and these escape maps and all sorts. And we're briefed and again, delayed and off we then briefed and it was all about. And the bomb aimer said, I don't know, it's all the heading of attack is all wrong for this bloody airfield and the stick length and everything. And he said, oh, you do as your buddy told. And we're flying fairly, wanted us to fly 25,000 feet when the opposition had got cameras and meteors and things, they could shoot us down, you know. Then somebody overrode that and said, if I was you, I'd get as high as you can. And off we went eventually. We got out to the aircraft and it was all bombed up and we were all very bit sober, you know, we're going to kill people. And that somebody had mentioned the fact, the possibility of a recall, and somebody said, oh, there'll be no turning back if we go, you know, that'll be it, see, so that was forgotten. And we all went out there waiting for the, just like a Second World War operation. You had a master bomber. I mean, it was just as if it had, not that we needed it. It was incredible bombing TR. Perhaps I hadn't ought to talk about this, but we could drop the bombs with NBS. We didn't need to.
NBS is
what? Navigation and bombing system with a radar at the back, like H2S, if you like. Didn't need to see the target visually, but it was somebody decided that it would be politic to be visually identify the target. So people were going to run up, somebody was dropping TIs, target indicators, with a master bomber watching the red TIs and all this. Then we'd come around and bomb our own TIs, or bomb the TIs, you know, instead of bombing it as you would normally. So very strange. Anyway, that was all organised and we were sitting there waiting to go. Air Marshal Cross, who was there as the big air marshal running it, he came out to every aircraft waiting to go and said, give them hell, chaps, you know, all that good stuff, you know. Well done, lads, give them hell, you know. all right, sir, you know, all that stuff, a bit of a morale boost, and off we went, rather quietly with these bit of chop, and then all hell let loose on the WT. The signal said, I don't know what the hell's going on. He said, there's somebody's, it's all in plain language. He said, well, then, well, you know, we've got a bomber code here that we've had a sign for, it's top secret. But it's all coming over, don't bomb Almaza, which we weren't going to anyway, or Cairo West, which we were. Come back, you know, Snowy Cooper says, come back. You know, all this, we recognised, and Robin Woodruff says, the group captain, come back, you know. Could be the enemy for all we know, you know, to lose that in this rupture. Anyway, we had a very experienced CO, was one Wing Commander Oakley, who was leading the thing. See. In the Guinness Book of Records, he was at the time, for decorations. DSO and Bar, DFC and Bar, DFM, AFC.
He's mentioned in the book somewhere.
Oakley, yeah, he's the first, yeah. And he calls up, breaks RT silence, and, you know, against all odds, he said, if I was you, let's all pack it in and we go back. It's obviously a genuine, you know, let's go back. So we got all these bombs on, and, you know, finally short runway at Malta, some fuel to burn off and whatever. And we came back, and Oakley, as he turned back, he was flying. A Canberra was flashed over his head, see? And he called this guy up and said, where are you going? He said, I'm going to Cairo West. He said, well, how are you? You come back. There'd be nobody markers there for the Canberras, you see? He'd been over there on his own. He'd missed the broadcast, you know? So he'd have been over there wondering what the hell was going on, you know? Because there's nothing going on. So when we came back, to our amazement, we couldn't land anyway because the second rain was going off, which seemed a bit strange. And eventually we landed and went in for the deep roof, and the signalists, they were still saying, what the hell's all this, you know? But, oh, there was no time to get the code out, you know, we couldn't start coding messages, we've got to get you back.
So you'd been recalled.
Yeah, well, the reason was, it's, yeah. I think somebody, I'm not telling any real stories, because I think somebody's mentioned this in a book about Suez. what nobody realised when we set course was that there was two civil American civil aircraft at Cairo West picking up the last of the American civilians. And, I mean, they weren't too happy, as you know. So we'd have been over there and could well have blown them up. See, and that was discovered fairly. We were already going then to blow it up then, you see. And when it was discovered, they said, for God's sake, you know, try to stop them.
So your target was the civil airport at Cairo, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Cairo West. But as I said, there was these civilians, American civilians, that would have gone down well, killing a few of those off. So it was prevented, you see. Now, you might wonder what happened after that. When I got back, my skipper went sick. He was got a very bad cold, you know, and he's got ear trouble. So I couldn't fly without a captain, can I? So we were four guys. He was sick, and I was sort of allocated just duties, you know. I was my job to get the sandwiches and some cold drinks for the guys for the briefing, or and for put them in a box for their taking the aircraft with them, you know. I managed to mess that up, actually, but that's another story, you know. But by the time my skipper was fit, and we'd only lasted a week, you see. We the next time we went, we just, it was a standby aircraft. Why have one standing by and not let them all go, I don't know. But we were a standby aircraft for a raid, and we didn't go because all the rest went. And so I never actually did anything. I never, if I'd have gone about another couple hundred miles and gone over the landmass of Egypt, I'd have got myself a general service medal, you know, but I'm not sorry.
But going back to your recall, when you all returned,
yes,
there was another way of going up.
Yes, to another airfield.
Oh, another airfield.
Yes, yeah, exactly, not Cairo West. And they did it, they bombed it, yeah, that was where they was going, yeah. Well, there was a lot of politics at the time, if you recall. Yeah, there was the Russians were having a go with the Afghani uprising, and they all looked a bit nasty, and they were threatening to didn't like the way we were tackling the Suez business, you know. So there was, and certainly the Americans were upset, as you remember. So I've just looked it up in the book. I think it was all of a week before we sort of panicked out there, and we all panicked back.
Now, when you were positioned out to Luca, had the Suez invasion started?
No.
So they all knew it was going to happen?
Well, this is the argument. This is the secrecy, as everybody knows, that we colluded, presumably, with the Israelis, and it was all, you know, well, we were supposed to go in there to stop the Israelis having, protecting our interests in the canal. But I think there was, as you know, there was obviously something going on, the way the aircraft were taking bombs out and so on, but we certainly knew nothing about it, really, except when we were told that we were going to bomb that night, you know, and it was delayed 24 hours, and there was that recall. So I was supposedly on the first raid, see, led by Oakley, a wing commander, our boss, but we never got there, and there were several raids after that, but it was all over in a week, as you know. I mean, they sent in the army and whatever. And then we got back to the UK. And then just before Christmas, they decided to... It was all over then. And that the troops were coming back. They sent out two valiants. I was one of them. We were going to have Christmas at home. And they decided to send two more valiants out there to Luca to show a bit of force again. And we just sat there and did a few cross countries and parked. And I was there over the Christmas and the New Year. And the guys were coming back from Suez there. The army was coming back, and National Service. And all the stops were pulled out trying to get them back home for Christmas, you know. But there was a few army officers and a few guys which they never couldn't make, and so they had to stop Christmas at Malta, and we had a smashing time actually with them. You know, they'd just come back from supposedly a bit of a war, and they hit that transit bar, and you know, Christmas had nothing to do, and all the boys had gone home except for a few army officers. And we had about five Christmas dinners, and I remember it was a good time. I remember moaning about it, about having to go, you know, in the last minute after missing Christmas at home. But I wouldn't have missed it, because it was quite a good time, really. We had a good time with these army guys, who were, you know, letting off steam in a way, you know, having come back from this.
So when you returned after Christmas, and you settled back into your old routine, did you, again?
Yes, yeah, that was all over. And then I was practicing to go on to America to take part in the SAC bombing competition, you know, as a RAF crew, as a few crews used to go over. And my skipper and me, and a couple of some aircraft were all going over there as guests. And somebody came back from Gaydon, having just done a simulator trip, and said, there's a guy called Flint on the next course next week, starting next week. Down to be, captain's course. I said, it's not a very popular name, you know. Perhaps it's me, you know. They said, it's you, I bet it's you, you know. So I said to my boss, I made a phone call. Yeah, it's Flint, you're going back to Gaydon. So I said to my boss, the CO, well, I'll tell you what, sir, if I can... be guaranteed a captain's course when I get back, I'll go to America first. And he said, you know, somebody else is going to get that perk to America. You get back to Gaydon to get yourself a crew, you know. So that was it. At the age of 25 and a half, I was a captain of a of a V-bomber.